Chapter 6. When she was with Jimmy McLean, Tessa would often experience a flash of suspicion, sometimes only for a second or so, but deeply skeptical nevertheless. That she recognized this as paranoia did nothing to alleviate the concern and well-entrenched anxiety. And here it was again, as he pulled the dirty old Rover off to the side of the road, surrounded by the brutal beauty of the Wicklow Gap. She would never even admit to the thing that disturbed her, the old idea that perhaps McLean had been responsible for the trauma and agitation in her past. Yet she never allowed the thing to formulate in her mind. She snuffed it out before it had a moment to get into sharp focus. It is a valley, the Wicklow Gap, that snakes through the mountains that form the backdrop almost wherever you are in County Wicklow. The road on which you navigate through the valley even takes you to Glendalough, of dreaded memory for Tessa, and the sprinkle of houses that is Rathdrum. The mountains dominate, and the crags and bluffs remain beautifully forbidding, no matter what the weather. They always came this way because it was truly safe to talk in the gap. The peaks and rock faces made it secure. Jimmy maintained that if you were out in the open in the middle of the valley, it was impossible to be overheard. Even sensitive directional mics were difficult to use in this terrain. Now, out of the blue, the name came into her head. Rory Deacon, whose real name, according to a couple of provos all those years ago, was Ralph Docking. She hadn't thought of him in a decade, so why now? Mentally she shook her head, as though physically throwing off the thought. Rory Deacon. He had disappeared as though he never existed. Vanished, gone. In the present, rain, clinging to a strong breath of wind, was blown up the valley like gun smoke. Jimmy stirred in the driving seat. Stirred, coughed, then spoke.
This time, it's madness. Impossible.
Oh?
Oh, indeed. My worry is that he'll go for it. And at the same time, I hope he will. It's a paradox. These are new clients, and they have some very serious provisos.
Well, show me.
He nodded as one hand went to unlock the glove compartment. Can you believe this?
Sliding the photograph out and turning it over. Tess flinched, as though she were the target and the bullets had just ripped through the windscreen. Jesus, she said, her voice almost lost, so that she repeated it. Jesus God!
One gloved hand to her cheek. Rarely was anything written. Little was actually spoken. Anything that was scribbled down was always destroyed. Faxes were never sent. Here, at the beginning of a new century, privacy was a thing of the past, and they went to enormous lengths to protect themselves. You see what I mean?
But who would...
She looked hard at the picture. The President of the Federation of Russian Republics stared back at her, the ghost of a smile around his lips. But the eyes dead, like glass eyes in a dummy. At the president's shoulder, his scandalously young new wife seemed to be elbowing her husband out of the way. President Oleg Bortunin, who had been elected in that extraordinary time of changing presidents following Yeltsin and Putin, had been a hard-drinking, mercurial, slickly tough politician until his dour, stolid wife had suddenly died. Oleg, everyone knew, had a tipsy, roving eye. But this did not prepare anyone for what was to follow. 3 months, almost to the day, after the demise of his wife, the president announced his remarriage. At the time, people quoted Hamlet. Thrift, thrift, Horatio, the funeral baked meats did coldly furnish forth the marriage tables. The new Madame Bortunin was half the president's age, a product of the worst girl-power excesses of the West, and caused a violent storm of reaction on her first appearance with her new husband. Dressed in the briefest of skirts, giving the cameras not only a view of exceptionally lovely thighs, but also a flash of crimson pants, she seemed to tower over Oleg. This was mainly due to the heavy platform boots and the hair, blonde, piled high in a swinging top-knotted tassel. The photographers went wild, and the tabloids shrieked headlines such as "Bortuza marries Spisakova girl." And from the Sun, "Oleg and Anastasia." For the bride's given name was indeed Anastasia. Every newspaper in the Western world, from the New York Times to the recently revived London Daily Sketch, which had nothing to do with news as we know it, displayed this bizarre marriage as something beneath contempt. Wrongly. Within a week, it was revealed that Madame Bortunin was not the mindless Bimbakova that she appeared. Anastasia was, in fact, the product of New College, Oxford, where she had not only won herself a first-class honours degree in political science, but also a considerable PhD in psychology. Yes, she was a brazen sex cat, but she had claws and a steel trap for a brain. The president was swiftly admitted to a private hospital in Switzerland, from which he eventually emerged looking incredibly fit, tanned, almost young, and bouncingly happy. From there, the president and his lady instituted a new and vital program of changes, setting the ailing federation on a new tough course, which, if the Bortunins did not swerve, could well be Russia's final salvation in this third millennium. Nobody doubted that the silk and lace-covered iron fist of Madame Bortunin was working Oleg. He had become the most expensive vent doll in the business.
"Her as well?" Tessa asked.
"Of course. You can't have one without the other." McLean nodded crisply, then opened the door and eased himself out into the drizzle, turning up the collar of his bomber jacket. Tessa joined him, shrugging her shoulders as she tugged at her collar, turning her back to the wind-blown rain. Carefully, Jimmy tore the photograph into confetti and let it dribble away from his fingers. Together they stood watching the mist obliterate the tops of the mountains.
"Who?"
she asked quietly, meaning who had contracted the killing. Just as they never spoke the name of the target, they had a rule about contracts. The man they called Alchemist had a series of edicts that were non-negotiable. For instance, they always had to know who was putting out the contract and making the running. Part of Jimmy's brief was that he had to meet representatives from the organization who wanted Alchemist's services. The meeting had to be very much one-on-one, and on their part, the contractors had to establish bona fides long before that meeting took place. It was essential, for if a terrorist organization could discover the way to Alchemist, then law enforcement or security forces could also sniff out the path and home in on the star of the show. It was relatively simple to make the initial contact, but very difficult to follow through, establish the facts, and make the face-to-face meeting. It took time and patience from both parties, and Jimmy had never gone into the precise details with Tessa. What she knew was that the early stages were negotiated by using the small ad services in daily newspapers. Oddly, while they were careful to the point of obsession about speech and written messages, the opening moves were always played out in plain sight. A kind of code was quickly established, and non-committal letters would go to and fro between nameless associates and faceless agents. The next stage was always the testing time. Tessa did not know it, but Jimmy McLean used many men and women who had been exposed to military or police experience and training. These were people who were familiar with the meticulous routines of covert trade and fieldcraft in a way that was intuitive. McLean thought of these people as his personal watchers, to use the old security service slang. These watchers were usually not intercognizant, neither did they know the true nature of their work. Many of the people doing this job imagined they were part of a private detective force used by several firms of solicitors. Once McLean had fingered the contact man or woman, several surveillance teams would be put into play. For weeks at a time, they would keep the subject under constant observation, drifting around the fringes of this person's world, like pilot fish around a whale, not only keeping an eye open, but also an ear. It was essential for the agents to be listeners as well, and their priority was to establish that the contracting organization was the genuine article. Early in Alchemist's career, it became a golden rule not to accept any approach as genuine until it was proved to be 110% unquestionable.